Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 624, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on February 10th of the year 2008. Well, there certainly is plenty to update, and regular listeners may have noted that it's been a number of months now, the better part of 6 months since I updated September 11th and related matters, and there is tons and tons of information to report about that. We're going to be getting to that. There's several different groupings of broadcasts, one dealing with the issue of weapons of mass destruction. There have been a number of developments of various kinds on various fronts vis-a-vis WMDs. We're going to talk about that. Also, the whole issue of economics 911, the various things having to do with matters economic and petroleum. Yet another aspect of the September 11th update, it concerns fifth column activities, because indeed it's looking very disturbingly as though one of the things that's gotten lost in the shuffle, not only is there a real threat to this country, but due in considerable measure to the petroleum industry and its deep, deep, deep tentacles running into not only the Middle Eastern oil-producing kingdoms, obviously, but also into the Bush administration and into the Muslim Brotherhood and elements like Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, and other GOP kingmakers who are deeply connected to, and in the case of Grover Norquist, in all probability, converts to Islam. And as the United States economy crumbles, as the U.S. Basically plunges into de facto bankruptcy, into the gap, so to speak, are stepping a lot of petroleum-enriched entities. And part of the result of that has been a triumph of the fifth column with some really, really, really scary developments. But we're going to be dealing with economics 911. We're going to be dealing with the fifth column. By the way, former Republican congressman from Michigan has now been busted for supporting Islamist financing, which should come as no surprise to veteran listeners to this program. But we're going to talk about the fifth column. We're going to talk about economics 911 and the buying of America by petroleum-related interests, including interests in the Middle East. And we're going to talk about WMDs, some frightening disclosures by whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, and other matters relating to 911. However, that will be in a number of different future broadcasts, because I've probably got enough material now for at least 3 or 4 hour-long programs, and we're going to be downloading that, and I'm going to be unloading that on you in weeks to come. But I thought before we leave off of September 11th and related matters for the time being, because we're going to cover a number of other stories in this broadcast, I thought I would touch on the Islamist connection to the Britney Spears story. Isn't that what you wanted to hear about, folks? You know you wanted to hear about Britney Spears. Actually, of course, I don't talk about tabloid-related stuff. The tabloids, including the CIA-connected National Enquirer, do a very good job of distracting people by focusing on the anorexic Aryan of the week, so to speak. And it's interesting to contemplate what lies behind this obsession with people like Britney Spears and so forth. Britney Spears is a creature of the Disney machine, and the Disney interests themselves have some interesting links. Not only is ABC Disney the third largest media corporation in the world, but ABC in the 80s was bought out by Cap Cities, whose main man was none other than William Casey, Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and CIA director. And also William Casey was the fellow who handled the State Department machinations for the Crusade for Freedom, an illegal domestic covert operation in which entire SS intelligence units and other Central and Eastern European fascists were imported into the United States for political purposes, grafted on to the Republican Party for political purposes, and they evolved into a Nazi wing of the Republican Party. One of the main financiers of Disney's resorts division, because Disney isn't just involved with ABC and with, of course, Disney movies, etc., but ABC, or Disney's resorts division, rather, has been to a large extent underwritten by Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia, himself an overt financier of Hamas, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. In Saudi Arabia, Prince Al-Walid presides over telethons to raise money for Hamas, again a branch of the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood. And so certainly the capital links between the Disney machine and elements in the Middle East, including the Muslim Brotherhood, are there. Whether that renders what I'm about to read significant or not, I don't know. I don't entirely dismiss the possibility that sort of an Islamist morality play is playing out for us before our eyes, or this just may be pure frivolity in which poor Brittany has gotten herself mixed up with yet another group of people with whom she has no business associating. But for those of you who were dying to know the links between Britney Spears and Islamism, here it is, folks. Before we deal with matters more substantive, from a website, page6.com, sort of a tabloid website, Brit files restraining order against Adnan, unquote, or question mark. Adnan Galib is her boyfriend slash bodyguard. And this is by one Jay Winter of January 20th, 2008. We read, it's been just a month since Britney Spears and Adnan Galib first spent a night together in an L.A. hotel, but their romance appears to be over. Sometime manager and pal Sam Lufty above showed the agency's photographers a copy of Britney's restraining order against Adnan last night. The LAPD has told Page6.com that no restraining order has been officially filed, but that doesn't mean Brit hasn't started the paperwork. By the way, we're wondering what's up with Sam's Adnan-like facial hair. Seriously, it's kind of scary. By the way, Sam Lufty's full name is Osama Lufty. He's a Muslim, too, or of Islamic extraction, according to some of the websites I've looked at, whether or not that has anything of significance to do with the following, and whether this has any overall significance, or whether it simply betokens the Saudi-slash-Islamist presence in the fast lane. But who is Adnan Galib in addition to being a Muslim? Over the past week or so, Adnan, who earned his expertise in weaponry fighting abroad in Afghanistan, Kosovo, and Macedonia, has been acting more bodyguard than boyfriend. The last time they were seen together was on Wednesday when a confrontation erupted at the Gaucho Grill in L.A., where Adnan allegedly threw chairs across the restaurant on the Pop-Tart's behalf. And there's more. Page6.com is hearing that's not the first time a woman has filed a restraining order against the snapper. The snapper, by the way, being Adnan Galib, apparently having fought in Kosovo, Macedonia, and Afghanistan. Sounds like Muslim Brotherhood, perhaps even Al-Qaeda. Who knows? So whether there's any significance to it or whether it's just yet another piece of distasteful fluff on an altogether distasteful story, that is the Islamist connection to the Britney Spears story, and I'm sure you were all waiting with bated breath for that one. What we're going to turn to next is a very disturbing story that once again I think highlights what this country lost when we gave away selective service. I do not agree with the idea of eliminating the draft. I didn't like it when it was eliminated in the wake of the Vietnam War. The framers of the Constitution did not want an all-professional military, and I think ultimately it's not good for the military, and it's even worse for the civilian section to have such a separation from the military and the civilian sector. For one thing, I'll guarantee you if there were selective service, if Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea were going to have their little kids sent off to Iraq, I don't think a lot of these people would necessarily be as oblivious to what's going on over there as they have been. As one Army Reserve officer who served in Iraq and has been very vocal on behalf of Iraqi veterans noted, the Army and the military are at war. The rest of America is going shopping. I don't think that's a healthy state of affairs. I also think that the fundamental ethics of the combat infantry squad are something that, I think most Americans, particularly these days, would do well to be inculcated with the social ethics of the infantry squad. To make a very, very, very long story very, very short, and man, am I attenuating here, one of the ironies of the so-called progressive sector Not only having lobbied to eliminate the draft, the Vietnam War sucked, but the draft was a good idea and should not have been gotten rid of. But then the generally anti-military attitude, such as the current expression, as I speak on February 10th of 08 with the Berkeley City Council in Code Pink, of unloading on the Marines, one of this country's more noble and noteworthy institutions. The military is the one genuinely socialist institution in this society, and in the military, the individual ego and personality are subjugated to the group purpose. And one of the things that's interesting about military, specifically the combat infantry unit, as exemplified by the squad, and a unit of anywhere from 7 to 12 men, is that the military is a socialist institution. And one of the things that creates the fondness that many military veterans feel for their military service, in spite of all the horror and all the frustration that can be attendant, certainly on, obviously, combat, and also some of the more authoritarian aspects of military discipline. But despite that, a lot of people who've served in the military have fond memories of their fellow service personnel because there's a degree of interdependence in the military that really does not exist in many other environments. There are some exceptions, but to make a long story short, a combat infantryman in the field is interdependent with his or her fellow infantry persons. Bottom line, you're out in the field, you're out in the boonies, and one of your comrades in arms runs out of ammunition, you give him half of yours. Runs out of cigarettes, you give him half of yours. Runs out of chocolate, you give him half of yours. Runs out of sea rations or water, you give him half of yours. And the reason is that if you're disabled by enemy fire out in front of your lines, and there's tracers basically winging back and forth from the two firing lines, you're assuming that somebody is going to crawl out and risk getting killed in order to save your A blank blank. And if you expect somebody to do that, you better be willing to help them when their you-know-what is on the line as well. This is obviously a bit of an attenuation and something of an oversimplification, but that's the essence of it. And I think that if there's anything that the average American needs to know, if there's a lesson that the average American needs to learn, it's that bloody goddamn lesson, that you are, mother bleeper, by God, your brother's or sister's keeper, whether you like it or not. And how can you institutionalize a single experience or act which will teach people, or at least expose people, to that fundamental social morality lesson? Well, the military would be a good way of doing it, and also people get free medical care for life after that. And another bad aspect of getting rid of selective service, aside from the fact that fewer people are exposed to that basic ethic, and that is that a professional military can begin institutionalizing certain kinds of abuses, such as dissolving the line between the line of separation between church and state. In a blog that is titled Truth Dig, we have an article by David Antoon. And David Antoon is a United States Air Force veteran, and what he is noting is the difference in the attitude of the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado toward religion from when he was a United States Air Force officer and the time his son enlisted in the U.S. Air Force Academy in order to become an Air Force officer. Again, from November 7th of 2007, an article by David Antoon entitled The Cancer from Within, this from the Truth Dig blog. I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Oath of office. Our mission is to educate, train, and inspire men and women to become officers of character, motivated to lead the United States Air Force in service to our mission. Air Force Academy mission statement. We will not lie, steal, or cheat. Air Force Academy honor code. Quote, military professionals must remember that religious choice is a matter of individual conscience. Professionals, and especially commanders, must not take it upon themselves to change or coercively influence the religious views of subordinates, unquote. This from the Air Force Code of Ethics of 1997 on religious toleration. How is that holding up? under the new all-professional Air Force? David Antoon writes, 42 years ago at the age of 18, I took the oath of office on my first day as an Air Force Academy cadet. The mission of the Academy was not only to train future leaders for the Air Force, but for America as well, because in the end, most Academy graduates do not serve full military careers. The Honor Code became an integral part of our everyday life. These are the values that I and most graduates of the 1960s and early 1970s took with us from our 4 years at the Academy. I, as did many graduates, underwent pilot training followed by tours of duty in Vietnam. Like military men and women of today, we did our best to become technically competent and professional leaders. Never during my 4 years at the Academy and subsequent pilot and combat training was the word warrior used, nor, whether as a cadet or officer, did I ever encounter Christian supremacist rhetoric. In April of 2004, my son, after receiving a coveted appointment to the United States Air Force Academy, asked me to accompany him to the orientation for new appointees. This 24-hour visceral event changed my life forever and crushed my son's lifelong dream of following in my footsteps. The orientation began with a one-hour warrior rant to appointees and parents by the Commandant of Cadets, Brigadier General Johnny Weida, W-E-I-D-A. The fact that the word warrior had replaced leadership was a signal of what was to follow. I later learned that cadets, to determine when a new record was established, had created a game in which warrior was counted in each speech Weida gave. My son and I then made our way to the modernist aluminum chapel, where I expected to hear a welcome from one or two Air Force chaplains offering counsel, support, and an open-door policy for any spiritual or pastoral needs of these future cadets. In 1966, the Academy had 6 gray-haired chaplains, 3 mainline Protestants, 2 Catholic priests, and 1 rabbi. Any cadet, regardless of religious affiliation, was welcome to see any one of these chaplains who were reminiscent of Father Francis Mulcahy of MASH fame. Instead, my son's orientation became an opportunity for the Academy to aggressively proselytize this next crop of cadets. Major Warren Watties, W-A-T-T-I-E-S, led a group of 10 young, exclusively evangelical chaplains who stood shoulder to shoulder. He proudly stated that half of the cadets attended Bible studies on Monday nights in the dormitories, and he hoped to increase this number from those in the audience who were about to join their ranks. This invitation, unquote, was followed with hallelujahs and amens by the evangelical clergy. I later learned from Air Force Academy Chaplain Melinda Morton, a Lutheran who was forced to observe from the choir loft, that no priest, rabbi, or mainline Protestant had been permitted to participate. I no longer recognize the Air Force Academy as the institution I attended almost 4 decades earlier. At that point, I had no idea how invasive this extreme evangelical cancer had become throughout the entire military, that what I had witnessed was far from an isolated case of a few religious zealots. In order to better understand this shift to a religious ideology at this once secular institution, I called the Academy Association of Graduates, AOG. Its response, quote, "We don't get involved in policy," unquote. What I didn't know was that the AOG, like the Academy, had affiliations with James Dobson's and Ted Haggard's powerful megachurches. When Dobson's Focus on the Family campus, unquote, was completed, the Academy skydiving team with great ceremony delivered the Keys from Heaven, unquote, to Dobson. During some alumni reunions, the AOG arranged bus tours of Focus on the Family facilities in nearby Colorado Springs, Colorado. I also learned that the same Monday night Bible studies discussed at orientation were taught by bust-in members of these evangelical megachurches, and that some spouses of senior Academy staff members were employed by these same religious institutions. It seemed that my beloved United States Air Force Academy had morphed into the Rocky Mountain Bible College. The Academy chaplain staff had grown 300%, while the cadet population had decreased by 25%. From 6 mainline chaplains to 18 chaplains, the additional 12 all evangelical. The Academy even gained 25 reserve chaplains, also non-existent in earlier times, for a total of 43 chaplains for about 4,000 cadets, or one chaplain for every 100 cadets. In the following weeks, a uniformed Army Major General William Boykin began sharing his Christian supremacist views from church pulpits around the country, declaring that he was God's warrior and that America is a Christian nation, unquote. He demeaned the entire Muslim world by stating that his God was bigger than a Muslim warlord's God and that the Muslim's God was, quote, an idol, unquote. He received little more than a token slap on the wrist. At the time, Joseph Schmitz, then the Department of Defense Inspector General, Schmitz is currently the Chief Operating Officer of Blackwater International, found that Boykin had committed no ethics violations. By the way, we're going to touch on Joseph Schmitz. Joseph Schmitz, by the way, again, Chief Operating Officer of Blackwater International, is a member of the Knights of Malta. More about that later. Note that at this point in time, Joseph Schmitz of the ultra-right-wing Southern California-based Schmitz family, along with John G. Schmitz, his father, and John P. Schmitz, his brother, or John G. Schmitz, I think John P. Schmitz is the brother, John G. Schmitz is the father, but it's an interesting group of people, and don't neglect to look up the Schmitz family in the Spitfire website, or on the Spitfire website in the For the Record descriptions. But note that at this point in time, Joseph Schmitz, now head of Chief Operating Officer of Blackwater International, was the Inspector General of the Pentagon, and more about him later. Continuing with Mr. Altoon's, with David Altoon's article here. Days later, the May 10th edition of The New Yorker featured the Abu Ghraib torture article by Seymour Hersh, who more than three decades earlier had brought us the story of My Lai. As a late critic of the Vietnam War, in which I lost many high school and academy classmates, I was skeptical and critical of the drumbeat for war orchestrated by the Bush administration. When then-Secretary of State Colin Powell again sold his soul in front of the United Nations and the world, the die was cast. I say again because as a major on his second tour in Vietnam, Powell whitewashed reports of the My Lai massacre and attempted to discredit and silence those few, most notably Ron Ridenour, who had the courage to get the story into Hersh's hands. These were some of my thoughts on the day my son had to decide whether or not to accept his appointment to the Air Force Academy. It was a time in my life when fatherhood and truth were confronted with faux nationalism. With tremendous courage and sadness, my son declined his appointment and ended his dream and my dream for him to attend the Air Force Academy. Though deeply saddened, we were not sorry. In what would have been my son's academy summer encampment, Chaplain Watties suggested, unquote, that cadets return to their tents and tell their tent mates they would burn in hell, unquote, if they did not receive Jesus as their Savior. At the same time, the Academy Commandant Weda made a habit of including biblical passages in official emails and correspondence to subordinates and cadets. He had developed a secret chant and response, unquote, with the cadets. When he yelled, "Air Power," the evangelical cadets in the know would respond, "Rock, sir," a reference to the Bible story that Jesus built his house upon a rock. Coincidentally, at this time and at the invitation of the Academy, the Yale Divinity School was observing the pastoral care program for sexual assault victims at the Academy. Under the leadership of Professor Kirsten Leslie, the Yale team issued a stunning report on the divisive and strident evangelical pressures by leadership and staff at the Academy. The response from Academy leaders was telling. They at first denied the reports of Watties' hellfire threats. Under media pressure, they later claimed the violations were committed by a visiting reserve chaplain when, in fact, they were by the recent Air Force Chaplain of the Year himself, Watties. In an interview after receiving his Chaplain of the Year award, Watties boasted of baptizing young soldiers in Saddam Hussein's swimming pool. It is difficult to think of more inflammatory and crusader-like behavior in an Arab nation. In response to the Yale report, the Academy demanded that Chaplain Morton denounce the report she had co-signed. When she refused, she was transferred to East Asia, ultimately resigning from the Air Force in protest. Morton was the only officer who put her oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, unquote, above careerism. The then DOD Inspector General Schmitz, noted for his Christian supremacist rhetoric in the book Blackwater, sent a team led by evangelical born-again Lieutenant General Roger Brady to investigate the Academy. Schmitz had recently found no ethics violations in the actions of General Boykin and allowed Boykin's promotion to senior military officer in charge of Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and extraordinary rendition, unquote. The Brady Report, unquote, found the Academy only to have an insensitivity problem. Air Force Academy graduate Brigadier General Johnny Wada, silenced, unquote, and removed from the Major General promotion list, was secretly promoted with back pay the following year at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Following the release of the Brady Report, West Point graduate and Secretary of the Air Force Mike Wynn, ignoring the existing code of ethics, issued another code of ethics, unquote, that allowed evangelical proselytizing. A month later, in an effort to appease the religious right, Wynn issued an even softer code of ethics, unquote. Amazingly, Wynn's document is in complete violation of the Code of Ethics issued in 1997 by Secretary of the Air Force Sheila Widnall, prohibiting proselytizing by commanders and other officers. The pre-existing Air Force Code of Ethics in the Little Blue Book states, quote, "Military professionals must remember that religious choice is a matter of individual conscience. Professionals, and especially commanders, must not take it upon themselves to change or coercively influence the religious views of subordinates," unquote. Here are just a few violations of that principle over the last 3 years. Academy football coach Fisher DeBerry hung a banner in the team locker room reading Competitor's Creed, "I am a Christian first and last. I am a member of Team Jesus Christ," unquote. Baseball coach Mike Hutchin, recruited from Evangelical Christian Bethel College, forced players to lead team prayer during practice. When asked about locker room prayer in March 2007, Lieutenant General John Regney, the Academy superintendent, responded, quote, "We have chaplains that are attached to each of the teams, and they are very important in that area," unquote. In a July 12, 2005 interview with the New York Times, Brigadier General Cecil Richardson, Air Force Deputy Chief of Chaplains, stated, quote, "We reserve the right to evangelize the unchurched," unquote. For over a decade, the official Academy newspaper ran ads stating, "We believe that Jesus Christ is the only real hope for the world. If you would like to discuss Jesus, feel free to contact one of us. There is salvation in no other name under heaven given by mortals by which we must be saved," unquote. The ads were signed by 16 department heads, 9 permanent professors, both the incoming and outgoing deans of faculty, the athletic director, and more than 200 Academy senior officers and their spouses. Mike Weinstein, founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, in just a few short years has received complaints from more than 6,000 service members and discovered church-state violations at the academies, at military installations in Iraq and around the world, and even within the inner corridors of the Pentagon. In 2005, when Weinstein filed suit against the Air Force for constitutional violations of church-state separation, the House of Representatives, with little public notice, passed a chilling bill that undermines enforcement of the First Amendment's separation of church and state. The Public Expression of Religion Act, H.R. 2679, provides that attorneys who successfully challenge government actions that violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment shall not be entitled to recover attorney's fees. According to the Washington Post, the purpose of this bill is to prevent suits challenging the unconstitutional government actions advancing religion. And we're going to come back to this story in Side 2. Are you getting scared, folks? You should be. This wraps up Side 2 of For the Record program number 624, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This has been recorded on February 10th of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.